The province's premier says he doesn't think he needs to respect the fixed date provincial election law his party introduced. Amendments to the Elections Act to fix the next election for July 15th, 2025, but the premier said yesterday he passed on an opportunity to end an early election speculation around a flurry of recent candidate nominations announced by his party. He told reporters that a call could come before the fixed date, depending on circumstances. Well, isn't that interesting? Circumstances. What does that mean, circumstances? He did not, he wasn't specific what he was referring to. I think it's pretty evident what he's referring to, and that's whether or not he thinks it's politically expedient or not to call an election. It's not about the betterment of the province. It's not about what would be best for everybody. It's about what would be best for him and his re-election bid. That's what it's about. And unfortunately, this is nothing new with politics. It's the same across the board, right? But you would think that at some point that a politician would stand by something. Just stand by something. Is nothing sacrosanct anymore? We've got a fixed election date for July 15th, 2025. Just stick with it. But of course, he's looking at it and saying, well, the Liberals right now are pretty weak with Zach Churchill. Probably not the strongest leader. Again, that's probably what he's speculating. And he doesn't want the NDP to really gain. So maybe if we call it sooner, then we can get another four-year mandate. And I think it's sad, actually. I think it's sad. Why not get down to the business of governing? You were elected to govern until next year. Govern. You've got all kinds of challenges to deal with. Healthcare, housing, affordability, the list goes on and on and on. Get down to the business of what you were elected to do instead of all of this campaigning. Endless campaigning. That's what Justin Trudeau and Pierre Poilievre, and they're constantly campaigning. They're always in campaign mode. And it's just, again, I think that this is wrong. The premier should stick to the fixed election date and put this to rest. What are your thoughts on that? I'll get to take your calls as we do each and every day between 11 and 12. Get your opinion on this or whatever else that you'll want to talk about. But again, I saw this story. I heard about this, and I just shook my head and said, really? Seriously? You're going to just put this to bed and say, we've got a fixed election date. We enact it, this date. We're going to stick to it. But no, they have to look at circumstances. And again, I just think that it's wrong. It's just plain wrong. Get down to the business of governing the province and taking care of some of the big issues that you promised that you would take care of, that you committed to. Like to thank Vanessa Vandenesse, of course, on the other side of the glass. The control board's doing a fine job, as always. A big game tonight for the Edmonton Oilers. Everybody knows, look, backs against the wall. All the cliches that you want to throw out there, but they can't go down 3-0. We all know that. It's just you can't do it. You never come back from 3-0, and they need a win tonight. But they're at home. Should be a raucous crowd in Edmonton. That is known to be a loud, very loud building. And you can bet Edmonton will throw everything they can at Bobrovsky, and they'll need to, as has been shown in the first couple of games of this series. But they need to get out to a lead. They need to get into Bobrovsky's head a bit and score some goals. It goes without saying. And McDavid's got to lead the charge. He's been quiet so far in the series. And your best players, again, sports cliche, your best players need to be your best players. That's the way it always goes. So we'll see how it all goes. All right, now joining me for a chat is Wayne McKay, law professor emeritus at Dalhousie University. Wayne McKay, thanks as always for joining the show. We appreciate it very much.
No problem. Always happy to do it.
Excellent. So a Nova Scotia judge has dismissed charges against two people accused of harassing the province's chief medical officer during the pandemic, saying the case took too long to get to trial. On just some background, back in 2022, police said an investigation into protests against COVID-19 restrictions outside the home of Dr. Strang led to charges of criminal harassment against Jeremy McKenzie and Morgan Guptill. And so this was set to go to trial next week, but the provincial court judge decided that the case had dragged on for too long. So this goes back to the 2016 Supreme Court of Canada ruling, correct, Wayne?
Yes, that's correct. The Crown versus Jordan ruling in 2016 from the Supreme Court of Canada in interpreting Section 11B of the Charter, which says you have a right to a trial within a reasonable time. They put a framework on that and put particular timelines for courts to meet, that if you're in provincial courts, the time from the charge to the trial had to be at least within 18 months. And if it was before a Supreme Court, it had to be within 30 months. So, and said some other things as well, but that's mainly what that 2016 Jordan decision said.
Do you agree with that Supreme Court ruling? Do you think that that's wise?
Well, I do in general. First of all, the charter requires that there be a trial within a reasonable time. And I think that is fair, that people accused of an offense, especially a criminal offense of this kind, need to know whether or not they're going to be convicted and how that's going to play out. They can't have it hanging over them forever. So I think most of us would agree with that principle. The fact that they set particular times, they did do a fair to have people present a lot of information and evidence and came up with those times as reasonable. They did say that in exceptional circumstances, you can make exceptions. And one of the interesting elements on this one is this was, of course, a COVID situation. And that has been found by courts to be one of the exceptional circumstances that they look at. Doesn't mean it's thrown out automatically. It means they have to look at all the evidence and realize that some of the delays that came during COVID were beyond anyone's control.
Yeah, I guess when it comes to the timeline, what are the reasons, I guess, is that there should be a certain amount of time that can't transpire? Is it just having somebody's life in flux a bit, or that's unfair? Is it that the evidence or the ability to have a proper defense might be compromised because of an extended period of time? Potentially witnesses may move or may subpoena? Whatever. What are some of the reasons why there's a timeline that is appropriate or affixed to this thing?
Well, all of those points that you made, which suggest to me, Todd, that you're developing some potential for law school here. You're on the right points. I mean, all of that does suggest that it's first of all, it does put a cloud over a person's life. While you've got a trial hanging over them for a serious matter, they in some cases may be in custody if they're not out on bail, those kind of things. But the other important points, the longer it goes, the more difficult it is to have good evidence, tracking down witnesses, memory of witnesses deteriorates over time, obviously, and other circumstances change that make it difficult to have the full trial. The lawyers that you want may or may not be available over a long period of time. So it's really tied in to the essential charter right that everyone charged with an offense has the right to a fair and reasonable trial within a reasonable time. So you're right. It's all of those kind of factors. Mm-hmm. There is a significant downside, which you're probably going to talk about in a moment, because when charges are stayed and it's thrown out, the victims of those crimes are left saying, well, what's fair about this? If you're a sexual assault victim or any kind of a victim in a crime and the case is thrown out, not having anything to do with the merits or whether they should have been convicted, but with the process, then they're, of course, rightly feeling hard done by.
Yeah, and that was, you read my mind, exactly what I was going to ask when it comes to victims. Is there anything in the charter that guarantees the victims' rights?
There isn't really, not in that sense. And there have, from time to time, governments have put in victims' rights statutes and so on with certain rights, but really nothing like the kinds of protections that are given to the accused. And even in this case, well, not even, but it seems that I think many people felt that what was happening to Robert Strang, who was, of course, the hero of the day in many days during COVID, and his service greatly to be applauded, to then have him and his family being harassed with phone calls and have people protesting on the sidewalk outside his home and calling him in the middle of the night and those kind of things. I think most people were pretty outraged about that and felt that that was very unfair to him. So I suspect he feels that he probably, I don't know, of course, but my guess is he would much prefer it went to court and that they did get reprimanded for their conduct. But that's not going to happen. Not going to be dealt with.
And in an era of misinformation and disinformation, this made the rounds of social media from people who are had serious issues with Dr. Strang and COVID restrictions and all of that. People have the right to feel that way. I'm not saying that they don't, but again, this made the rounds as if, look, there was nothing to this case. See, it was dismissed. They did nothing wrong, and that to me does a disservice to the narrative as well.
Well, absolutely, and then definitely in the world of social media and conspiracy theories and so on. You're exactly right that lots will say, well, look, here's another case being thrown out and more evidence that the whole thing was misguided and people were oppressing and us and throwing away our rights for no good reason and all that. And it has, as we just talked about, absolutely nothing to do with that. The merits of the case were not looked at and will not be looked at. Whether they should have been convicted, we'll never know. And that is unfortunate. And it's another layer of that. I believe I'm right about this, that one of the people who would have gone to trial had been charged was the leader of this Diagonal group, which even Prime Minister Trudeau has referred to a white nationalist supremacist kind of group, and a former Afghan veteran who has a fair bit of charges of violence, not necessarily convicted. Anyway, it's a situation where it can be played in an inappropriate way to support some not very good causes.
Yeah, so what's the challenge here? Do we not have enough administration ability? Do we don't have enough judges? Do we not have enough Crown prosecutors? What is going on here? Why has this dragged on in this way?
Well, that's the big systems point, which is so important. It's, again, kind of all of that. I'm not sure if there's any vacancies right at the moment, but for much of the time, there have been vacancies on the provincial court and not enough judges to handle that. And that still seems to be a big problem. There's a lot more cases coming forward. Seems to be a growth, unfortunately, in violent crime since COVID in some way, not necessarily connected to it, but just more cases to be dealt with. And the prosecution service, which is really the key, has long argued that they're under-resourced and under-supported. And what that leads to is, first of all, needing more new people to come in. New Brunswick, for example, just added, I think, 30 recently to their prosecution service because of similar kinds of issues. And secondly, because it's a difficult work situation where they're not fully supported and working very hard, a number of more senior prosecutors have left. And so I think it's a combination that is really problematic in terms of dealing with this issue. And it's an issue that the government really, I'm sure, need to pay attention to in a big way. I guess one more little factor to throw out there, I saw some statistics. The number of successful applications for staying proceedings because there was not a trial in a reasonable time has more than doubled in 2023 compared to the previous time, and over the full period from, I think they started looking at about 2016 to the present, it increased, the number of applications increase every year and the number of cases granted increase every year. So it's a bigger problem because the resources are not there.
Is a tactic of defense lawyers potentially try and drag things out, if possible, to get past the post here with this time horizon?
Well, they can't in a direct sense because the Supreme Court was wise enough to say it's delayed due to the government, to the Crown, or the courts, but the Crown mostly, that delays caused by defense do not count against the time period. And in this particular case, the provincial court judge did subtract. I think it was actually a longer time. It was a longer time than, and it was only 19 months. It was 1 month over the 18 months requirement. And it was more than 19 months if you counted delays caused by defense counsel. So that does not count. They also do take account. They will subtract off the requirement of the time if it's an exceptional circumstance. And I assume, I'm sure the judge did look at that as well, where some of these delays due to COVID, which is an unusual and exceptional circumstances. But even when she subtracted those, she felt that the delays caused by the Crown were over the required 18 months. And in particular, they had an opportunity to try them together with some other cases of a similar kind that would have brought it within the 18 months. And they did not do that for whatever strategic reasons. So I think it was clear that they looked at problems caused by the prosecution.
Wayne, always great. Appreciate your insight. Thanks so much.
No problem. Always a pleasure.
All right. Take care. That's Wayne McKay, law professor emeritus at Dalhousie University. A growing concern, more newborns in Nova Scotia without a family doctor. We'll discuss this when we come back. All right. I saw this story on the CTV website. I'll read a bit of it. As an aspect of the doctor shortage we rarely hear about, recently obtained data shows the number of newborns in the province without a family doctor climbing, and it is also raising concerns for the health of newborns and their parents. In a Freedom of Information request obtained by the Nova Scotia NDP party, the numbers show that nearly 16% of registered births last year were referred to the Nova Scotia Health's Unattached Newborn Clinic, also known as UNC. This clinic on Mumford Road cares for newborn babies who don't have a family doctor or primary care provider, began operating in 2022. Early numbers show referrals to it has steadily climbed each quarter, and in 2023, of the more than 5,900 registered births in Nova Scotia last year, around almost 1,000 were referred to the clinic. Now, the NDP says this is a good time for the province to expand its midwifery program, which could help ease the strain and fill some gaps in primary health care. Joining us to chat about all of this is Shannon Kopp, a member of the Association of Nova Scotia Midwives. Shannon, thanks for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. I guess first and foremost, I mean, how stressful must this be for young moms, eh?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can just imagine, you know, you have a new baby, you've just come home with your baby, and you have no one to call. You have no one to see if anything happens with the baby, if you have questions. Our clients with midwifery care, we see them for 6 weeks postpartum. So they have access to us. But at 6 weeks, when we discharge them from care, they're kind of left in the same boat if they don't have a family doctor to take their babies to. So the Unattached Newborn Clinic has been functioning, and, you know, in fairness, they're overloaded. Just like, you know, we don't have enough family doctors for our adult patients. So, yeah, we don't have enough family doctors for our newborn patients as well. Mm.
Okay. What exactly do what are your services? What do midwives do?
Well, I mean, that's a loaded question, because what currently we do in Nova Scotia is we do prenatal care, we do intrapartum care, so labor and birth, and then we do postpartum care. And as part of all of that care, we also provide counseling on birth control options. We can prescribe for most concerns that arise in pregnancy. Within that postpartum period, we do breastfeeding supports. So in other areas, midwives are doing more. And I think that's what we're looking at. How can we help our healthcare system here, and where, in ways we can work to fluoroscope. In Nova Scotia, we've kind of been pigeonholed into, we are just doing this prenatal, intrapartum and postpartum care.
Okay, tell us more about expanding scope. Give me some examples of what you'd like to see, how the scope expand.
Well, I mean, it's within our scope. It's not even expanding our scope. It's just using midwives to their full scope. So Okay. Things like cervical cancer screening, we can do more sexual reproductive health care, postpartum care for those people, the people who've had babies who didn't have a midwife. There are postpartum programs in other parts of the country where midwives can take on that load as well. So not just the babies, but also the adults. Breastfeeding supports. There are areas in the country where midwives are providing abortion care. There's lots of different options where we could fill gaps that are, exist in this province.
So are midwives employees of the health authority, or are they individual contractors, or both?
In Nova Scotia, we are employees.
Employees of the healthcare, of the yes. health authority?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
is that a good model, do you think?
It is. There are definitely other models across the country. There's pros and cons to any model. But I do think the employee model does give us significant benefits that other models do not.
Okay, how so?
Well, it does allow for us to work in different ways. For example, if the health authority would, give us, kind of allow us to, let's just pretend we are going to set up a postpartum program for parents who have had a baby with obstetricians or with family doctors who don't have an ongoing family doctor. The health authority would be paying me to do so. I wouldn't need to kind of source alternate funding like in other jurisdictions.
Okay, so is it the mother that chooses that to have midwife assistance, or how does it work?
Yeah, they self-refer. So they contact our clinic, fill out an intake form. We can't accommodate all of our requests. We are just overrun. Probably about 40 to 50% of our people who request care, we cannot accommodate right now. The wait lists are long. However, they do request services. And yes, we would see them throughout their pregnancy on the same schedule you would see an obstetrician or family doctor. We can do all the same lab work, ultrasounds, tests. They can choose to have a home or hospital birth. If something arises in their pregnancy where they need a higher level care, because of a higher risk complication, we would refer or consult our obstetrics colleagues. It's really client choice.
Okay, the number of women wanting to go that route, is that rising as awareness is happening, or what can you tell us about the demand?
I can tell you the demand greatly exceeds our capacity currently. Yeah. There is growing demand. In Nova Scotia, we only have 16 midwives in the entire province in 3 sites, and that has not expanded since midwifery was introduced in 2009. So as more and more people hear about it, we're also seeing a lot more people come from outside of the province, mm-hmm. And asking for midwifery care because they've either experienced it in other areas or it's the norm in other countries where midwifery care is the first line. So they're coming here looking for midwives, asking for midwives, and unfortunately, in a lot of cases, being disappointed that they can't access a midwife.
Yeah, why do you think we're so slow to increase? Any speculation as to why the health authority's not? I mean, you mentioned since this was introduced in 2016. Was that when it was introduced? I remember that correctly?
It was introduced in 2009. Midwifery started with three pilot sites,
right?
Antigonish, South Shore, and IWK. They've not increased those 3 sites. We've increased the number of midwives slightly since 2009. We're now at 16, but
right.
We haven't increased the number of sites. So there's a great deal of people across the province who can't access midwifery care. And midwifery care is well situated, especially in some of those rural areas where people have to travel to access care. If they had midwives in the communities, and looking at our Indigenous communities, for example, with high birth rates, if we had, Indigenous midwives in their communities, they can serve the populations. We know midwifery care is excellent outcomes. It's very well studied to show that there's lower intervention rates, greater satisfaction rates. So I'm not exactly sure what the barriers are at this stage.
Okay, Shannon, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
No problem. Thanks, Todd.
All right, take care. Shannon Kopp, a member of the Association of Nova Scotia Midwives. Food bank usage. We've talked a lot about this, folks, but the numbers continue to be grim. We'll discuss it with Nick Jennery when we come back.
Todd.
I remember the 35 sweet
All right, so when it comes to food bank usage, the statistics, the stories, they just continue to roll in and on the increase with no end in sight. Joining us to chat about all of this is Nick Jennery, Feed Nova Scotia's Executive Director. Nick, it's I don't get me wrong, I like having you on the show, but my oh my, it seems every time I have you on, we have to talk about bad news, eh?
Well, that's true, Todd, but hopefully we've got some hopeful news as well this time through.
All right, so what is, do you have some hopeful news for us?
Yeah, I do. Well, let's start with the bad news first, because you're right. I was just looking at the numbers for January to May of this year, and what we saw was 169,000 visits to food banks, and that's up 21% over last year. We saw and supported 43,000 unique individual Nova Scotians. That's up 11%. So it's about 1,700 people a day that are getting supported by just the food banks alone. And HRM leads all the other municipalities in terms of the number of new people entering the system. And last May, it's about 10%. So the numbers are not good. What I would say is that I think we've got two big opportunities. One, on the political front, if you look at it, we've got three elections scheduled within the next 15 months at the municipal, provincial, and federal level. This means that there's going to be new municipal councillors, new leadership in Nova Scotia's two largest municipalities, new MLAs, a new mandate for the province, a refreshed cabinet, and potentially some significant changes at the federal level. And we're now in that pre-election period. Parties are building their campaign apparatuses. They're recruiting candidates. They're engaging stakeholders. And they're developing their policy platforms. Right around the door, candidates will be knocking on your door, eager to introduce themselves and learn about the local, provincial, and federal needs of the communities. This is your one time in four-year opportunity to say what's the plan. And I think if your listeners, if all of us said, look, three things. We're concerned about the trends and people being left behind. We're concerned about the cost of the healthcare system, which you're trying to fix, because unhealthy people are usually people who can't eat food or don't have access to food. And then I care about my neighbors in my community. So what's the plan? That's the first thing that I think we can do on the policy front. The second thing is that we've recognized that our politicians are just not going to step up to the plate in the way that we want them to. So increasingly, we are looking to communities and joining forces with them to build up some really innovative ideas. I mean, just things that we've just recently helped finance and sponsored, like the Front Street Community Oven up in the Valley. And what they do is that, you know, they bring people together, share meals. It's a very inclusive strategy. If you go on Front Street Community Oven, you'll see lots of good things. We think that's a really great way to bring people together, to share food, share some stories, and get people in a better place. If I look at like Hope Blooms, and that's an organization many people know for the salad dressings they put on the shelves in Superstore. You know, they grow the food, they get that listing on the retail store, and with the money they make, they put black kids through post-secondary education. Really good. And now they just got they were bequested. They got some farmlands in Lunenburg County, about 4 acres, if I remember rightly. And they want to learn how to be farmers so that they can grow their own product, double the yield, get more salad dressing, sell some more stuff, get more kids through post-secondary school. We think that's a really good idea. So we help sponsor that. The mobile food market is something that was established back in 2016. Fresh fruits and vegetables on a truck going around to under-supported communities. We again sponsored one of their ideas to have a pop-up market just right around the corner from where we are every Tuesday evening. I volunteered there, and it is a wonderful operating model where it is substantially below retail costs. It gives people the chance to buy one tomato or one lemon all sorts of fresh fruits and vegetables. So again, really good ideas. And the last one I would just throw in there, and there's 24 of them that we've just sponsored, this idea of, I think, yeah, it's the Kingston Memorial Community Health Center, that if you go there and suffering from a chronic disease, which is clearly related to an unhealthy diet, you can get a script for fresh fruits and vegetables. Now, that's not a new idea. It's been going on in the States for a while, but we think it's an idea worth trying here in Nova Scotia. And if it works, see if it can be, you know, scaled up to other areas. So lots of community efforts being done, and we are very committed to getting behind that because we think some of those community-led solutions in a collective way will make a difference.
Okay, so when it comes to government, back to government, and I agree with you that the community-led initiatives are amazing and people deserve a lot of credit. But but the government, I think, unfortunately, when politicians are knocking on doors, people, I think in many cases, will say, well, this problem has been around now. It's continued to get worse. And I talk to HRM counselors here all the time, and they all kind of deflect and say, well, the province is to blame, and the province, everybody seems to be kind of pointing the finger at everybody else. I don't know that people have a whole lot of faith that anybody elected is going to be able to take care or move the needle in the right direction. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, one thing I would say is that we are now celebrating our 40th anniversary in being in existence. And when I look at the records back 40 years ago, everybody was talking about how to put ourselves out of business. So it's a sad reflection of all the things that you've just said. I do think, though, that those politicians, if they hear enough voices, particularly at the councillor, municipal, and the MLA level, that, oh, it looks like food security and community health really is at, on top of mind with everybody. If you change the public dialogue, you will change the political dialogue. And if you change the political dialogue, then what you're going to get is hopefully some action. Because if all of us say this, enough of us say this, we'll get that critical mass of opinion that gets out there. You only have to look at the housing crisis or the mental wellness challenges that we had. Again, the public voice is always the first step, and then the politicians can't ignore it. But I think there are things that government can do that literally cost them no money. If I look at the Canada Disability Benefit that's just came in from the feds a month ago, this is about $200 a month for people on disabilities. And we know 12% of people age 15 and older with disabilities live below the poverty line. If it's up to the provinces how they treat that. There have been times in the past where they would claw back that supplemental income off your income assistance. And when you think about it, how crazy is that? You've got somebody on income assistance well below the poverty level. Don't claw back incremental or supplemental benefits or income. Let people have the money that they need that at least gets them to the poverty level. It would cost no money from the province's standpoint. So I think there are areas that, you know, can be done.
Well, guaranteed income, and we hear that floated federally. What are your thoughts on a guaranteed income of some sort?
Well, you know, whether it's a basic income, a guaranteed income, you know, we had two insights to the impact of that. When CERB came around, we saw a noticeable decline in the number of people going to food banks. Why? Well, I mean, I would venture to say people would rather buy their own food and be independent and all of those things. They don't want to go to shelters and food banks and meal programs. So CERB was a real indication of what sort of an impact that can have. The other thing we saw in Ontario a few years back, they had a basic income pilot. So let's do a pilot. Let's see what it tells us and make a policy decision based on that. Unfortunately, they only got 2 years into it when the Ford government canceled that. So I would say rather than sort of guess at it, let's do a basic income pilot. Let's see what it would do. One of the pilots that we are going to do, and it's going to cost around, if I remember right, just north of $300,000, that we are going to have preloaded debit cards and selectively make them available to a number of targeted communities and see at what level of income do people stop going to food banks and reaching out for support. We know that they would rather have their own income to buy their own food. What we're going to try and figure out is what that threshold level is, and then use that to show government, look, in the absence of you doing a pilot, we did one, and here are the results.
Okay, Nick, listen, I appreciate your time. Thanks for doing this, and we'll be in touch. We'll talk again.
Okay, Todd, listen, all the best.
Thanks. All right, take care. Nick Jennery, Feed Nova Scotia's executive director. A Cogswell District project. This is a big one, folks. We'll chat with the project manager for HRM when we come back. Todd. All right, a pretty massive undertaking happening in our city, Cogswell District Project, including a Barrington Street closure in an area. Alora Wilkinson is the project manager with HRM, joins us to talk about all of this. Alora, thanks for joining the show.
No problem. How are you doing today, Todd?
Well, yourself?
Not too bad.
All right, so this is a biggie, eh? This is a massive project, goes without saying.
It is. It's one of the biggest Halifax has undertaken in a little while. So we're pretty excited to see the transformation.
Absolutely. Let everybody know what the plans are here.
Yeah, so we're about halfway through this four-year construction project. So we're 2 years in. We've got about a year and a half, 2 years left to go. Starting June 17th is going to be one of our biggest phases that we've entered, and also one of the more disruptive phases for people coming into downtown to get us through the next milestone and through construction. So what's going to happen on June 17th is that Barrington Street at Duke Street is going to close. So that includes the entire Scotia Square transit terminal that's there all the way down to Barrington at Cogswell Street. At the same time, we've been working to build what we call a detour road, which will come down from Cogswell Street at Brunswick Street and connect into the intersection that's there today at Barrington and Upper Water Street. So while we're closing Barrington Street, we are creating a new route for traffic, and transit is relocating to new bus stops throughout the downtown, with a prominent bus stop being on Granville Street between Duke and George Street. And all of that is being done to allow us to tear down the last bridge that remains of the overpass. So there's a bridge that runs along Barrington Street towards Cogswell Street, and then there's a lot of soil that needs to be excavated and moved from the site, thousands of cubic meters of soil that need to leave for the retaining wall, both along Upper Water Street and down by Barrington Street, which will allow us to completely regrade Barrington Street and Cogswell Street over the next few months throughout the summer, which will get us to the end of this current phase that we're entering at the end of December this year, which will hopefully bring us to have Barrington Street from Duke all the way to our new roundabout at Nora Bernard completed, and parts of Cogswell Street coming down from Brunswick towards Upper Water completed. So a really big transformation for how the street operates and getting that base grid in for us. So we're really excited to reach that milestone at the end of this year.
All right, so you're hoping by December that this Barrington Street road closure and all of these street closures will be done and everything will be realigned. That's the goal?
That is the goal, yeah. We want to get transit back where they belong before winter starts. So we need to get the asphalt in place before the asphalt plant closes. So we're working towards a really tight timeline. But we've got the team to do it, and we're ready to get started.
What is the what's the cost of this project, and what's the cost sharing? I'm assuming there's cost sharing with levels of government?
Yep. So the overall budget for this project is about $120 million. There was an announcement the other day that the provincial government has given us $2.5 million to help with some of the bridge removal, the soil remediation that I just talked about. So they've contributed. There's also different cost sharing with other partners such as Halifax Water and Bell Alliance. and abutting property owners in the area that's allowing us to upgrade all of the infrastructure here.
Okay, so when all is said and done, there's going to be housing units and mixed use and in that area. That's the plan, is it?
It is. So my team and the work we're doing under construction right now is getting the base grid in, it's getting the parks in, and it's creating the development block. So that's the first phase of this project, which will be completed. We're targeting end of 2025. Once we've created those blocks, and there will be about five blocks that HRM owns and will be able to sell for development in the future, we have an open process right now through our planning department that's engaging with the public on what they want to see for these development blocks in the future and how they should be zoned and what that's going to look like as we get ready to talk about selling the land and how we're going to dispose of this land and what we do with it. But there's approximately the ability for 3,400 units in this area. So quite a lot of opportunity for development and new housing, which is really exciting right downtown.
Okay, so of the $120 million cost that you're talking about, just $2.5 million coming from the province, but creating the tax base that these houses, and I'm assuming that there will be revenue coming back to the municipality when developers want to purchase some of that very lucrative land, right? So there'll be money coming back the other way, I'm assuming here.
100%. So at the beginning of this project, when it went to council, kind of the first few times to really get going and to get initiated, the conversation always factored in the fact that the land that we would be able to sell would offset some of the costs of construction. Exactly how much of that's going to be offset is yet to be determined. So council, because we own the land, have the opportunity to set different requirements between, you know, the height, the density, the requirements for affordable housing, that sort of thing. So all of those factors that can get added onto the land as requirements as part of the sale will impact the overall cost. And so that'll be a decision that comes to council probably early to mid next year for discussion to see what we ultimately want to do with this land and what opportunities we want to jump on in this situation.
Okay, so when all is said and done, what's the parcel of land, what's the footprint here that's included that the housing or whatever's going to go into this will be? What's the footprint?
I don't have the exact footprint of the parcels of land themselves and what the total will be, but the Cogswell Interchange is about 16 acres of land that we're using overall. So that'll include the development blocks, the parks, as well as the street right-of-way. So it's a pretty significant chunk of land right downtown.
Okay, so when it comes to the streetscape, the way that the traffic flow and all of that stuff, are you fairly confident that it's going to be much better than what was there?
Yeah, I think we've done a lot of work up to this point. A lot of consultants and engineers have spent a lot of time thinking about how to redesign this area. It's always been kind of an odd piece of land downtown, right? Many people call it the highway to nowhere. You came up on this pretty robust highway infrastructure and then came right back down to our historic street grid. So we've spent a lot of time creating a new street grid that reconnects downtown and the North End that's more pedestrian-friendly, transit-friendly, cycling-friendly, while still can accommodate the volumes that are coming into town, both with the port and people coming over the bridge. So we've done the work, and we're confident that the new roads that we're building will work for all modes trying to get into town.
All right. Always, like everybody's always concerned with cost overruns, and I suppose you don't know how everything will shake out, but are you fairly confident that this thing's going to come in budget?
Yeah, you know, there's always surprises. There's a lot of unknowns underground, but right now we're feeling pretty good about where our budget sits for the scale of the work that we've been doing.
Right, so if everything goes to plan, this thing, as far as you're concerned, and what HRM and will be done, and ready to for housing or whatever else, it'll be set for that at the end of this year then.
So our main grid, so again, that Barrington connection will be completed by the end of this year. 2025, we still have work that we need to do. So at that point, there'll be tweaks to Upper Water Street as well as updated work to the parks and some of our smaller side streets and multi-use paths. So there still will be work going on in 2025. That will take us to the end of December 2025, so that's our kind of true substantial completion of this project. But the end of this year, you'll see a huge regrade and alignment change of the street.
Okay, great stuff. Thanks, Laura. Appreciate your time.
No problem. It was great chatting.
All right. Take care. Alora Wilkinson, project manager with HRM. Should be interesting to see how it all shakes out. All right, folks, we got some time for you. What is on your mind today? The way to reach us is 902-405-6000. Again, 902-405-6000. How about the idea of the Nova Scotia Premier saying, well, an election before the fixed date, which we set in stone of July 15th, 2025, well, that may be necessary based on circumstances. That's what he said yesterday. What are your thoughts on the idea of an early election? And a lot of speculation happening because of nominations are happening around the province, and a lot of speculation as to why are these nominations happening. Anyway, that or whatever else you'd like to get into, 902-405-6000. What is on your mind today on this Thursday, 902-405-6000? And open hour when we come back.